Hi, everyone. It's weird when you first hear your own voice. So. Hi, I'm Matthew Minella, and this is Jose Rade Allende, and welcome to our talk, DevOps at Scale, Leading an Autonomous DevOps Team. We both work at Microsoft on the Visual Team Services Group. We're on the team that works on the work item tracking system. And today we want to talk to you about a transformation that our organization went through about 5 years ago and continuing on to today, to go from a box product long ship cycle to a DevOps organization shipping continuous value to customers every 3 weeks. And this has been a very long journey for us. And what's interesting for me and Jose is that, like, you know, we're not upper management. We've worked on a team first as individual contributors and now running a team. But we have this perspective of this transformation, both from what our organization had to do to make it work, but also from us as running a team, what our team had to do to react to this change and to be effective ourselves. And so during this talk, we want to hit both points. We want to show you how the big changes we had to do to make it so that the entire organization had to succeed, and the changes that we had to do as a team. And so during the presentation, we'll show you snapshots of what our team looked like at these different points of transition and talk a bit about what that meant for me and Jose and our team members. So I feel this is a interesting topic for many of you, and I want to kind of do a quick poll of the audience. How many of you consider your company's teams to be DevOps already? Just raise a hand. Okay. How many of you want to consider yourselves to be DevOps? Okay. Awesome. So I'm hoping that this will be a valuable talk for all of you in a couple of ways. One is that learn from us, or learn what not to do from us. Also, for you to give us feedback if you say, hey, great talk, guys. I hope you say that. And then say, but I think this, you guys should have done this differently. I would love that, because there's not one way to do DevOps. It's a buzzword, right? Everyone's using it. But it means something different to every team. And so in our transformation, what we learned is that for us, DevOps is a combination of culture, process, and tools. And what we mean is, so by process is, DevOps is often attributed to shipping faster, giving incremental value. But to move faster, you need to have the right process set up so that you can be successful. And so first step is establishing what is the way your organization works to be able to move faster. Culture is important too, because you need the engineers, the managers, everyone in your organization to really value shipping to customers quickly and being customer focused and obsessed. Because DevOps really is about the customer, right? The goal isn't to ship faster just for you, for fun. It's to get value, get feedback from customers. And that has to be a core tenet of your culture, that you care about it, that it bothers you when customers aren't successful and aren't happy. And it's the thing that drives you every day. And last but not least, tools. So while I really believe tools shouldn't dictate your process, dictate your culture, they are there to help you, right? The tools you use shouldn't get in your way, but they should enable and bolster you to be successful. And this is really important to us, because working in Visual Studio Team Services, we deliver an application lifecycle management solution. And so it's very important that the product that we build is the same thing as the product that we use, and it should make you successful at being DevOps. And so with that in mind, this is our story of what we did to get to that point. And our focus for our organization during this change was on three key things. It was, we want our teams to be self-managed, right? We want our teams to feel empowered and autonomous to work the way they want to work. We wanted to have a 3-week ship cycle across the entire organization for every team to hit that cadence. And we also wanted to have both a concept of top-down and bottom-up planning. And what we mean by this is that let the organization at a high level set goals, like big goals for everyone, but let each team have the autonomy to determine how do they achieve those goals? What do we need to do to make that? And it's up to us to decide that. And for me and Jose running a team, this is very satisfying. Right? We'll hear from higher up in our organization, hey, we really want to target this scenario. We really think this is a key thing for us to succeed at. And it's like, but now we're not going to tell you how to do it, right? You guys go, figure it out, show us what your plan is, but it's up to us to really own that. And it gives us a feeling of empowerment, of pride that we can now connect with customers on what we're driving ourselves.
So as Matt mentioned, we're part of the team services group. Probably some of you will be familiar with Team Foundation Server. And that's our on-prem offering. As Matt mentioned, 5 to 6 years ago, we had this goal. We wanted to become a group that could ship in quicker cadences. And the product that we have that offers that is Visual Studio Team Services. However, we remain a group that has to make sure we not only ship a hosted solution, but we also still continue to ship a high-quality on-prem solution. For those not familiar with Team Foundation Server, the goal of this tool is to provide your teams and your organization with the right tool set to enable collaboration, allow you to be more agile, while providing a version control system, whether you call it Git, TFVC, entirely up to the organization, and promoting continuous integration, continuous deployment. In a nutshell, kind of the value proposition of the tool is Team Services is a tool that allows you to plan better, code together, and ship faster. An important thing to consider is that we develop Team Services using Team Services. So we don't take these value prop lightly. For us, we use it to plan better, to code together, and to ship faster. Now, our product group is distributed across the globe. We have 35 feature teams, around 436 employees. Matt and I, we happen to be located in Redmond, Washington, but as you can see, we have groups all around the world, and we need to make sure, as an organization, we can collaborate effectively, not only with people that are located on the same place, but also different time zones, different locations. As a company, as Microsoft, now we're not only talking about Team Services organization, but as Microsoft, we're pushing really hard for this idea of having a one engineering system. What does that mean for us? That means that the tool we are creating is a tool that we want all Microsoft to use to develop their own practices, to be agile in their own way. And here's just a graph of how our user base has grown internally. This is not even considering our external customers, it's just our internal customers. And this slide is important because it gives you an idea of how important it is for us to make sure that if the tool is good enough for us, then it should be good enough for you. And if it is not, we should put work into it to make sure it meets our baseline, what is needed to make sure our teams can collaborate effectively. Now, destination, kind of the overall goal of this presentation is showcase to you guys how we went from Team Foundation Server to something that looks more like this. Not only Team Foundation Server, but also Visual Studio Team Services. A product that ships every 3 weeks. We deliver continuous value to our customers. We iterate on it. We keep getting it better. And then when it's stable, when it's good, when it's high quality, we also make sure that it's high quality and hosted, but when it's up to standards, we just include that same value on-prem. So throughout the presentation, we'll be touching on how the organization made sure that was the case, and how having autonomy as a team really, really helped us to make sure we kind of feel that sense of purpose, of ownership, of what we do is, it really matters and impacts our customers.
So to understand where we got to, how we got to this 3 week ship cycle, and how we got to feel very, have the ability to deliver incremental customer value and respond to feedback, it's important to step back and say, where were we 5 years ago? What were our problems, and what did we have to fix to get to where we are? I joined the group about 5 years ago. So it's interesting for me because I joined the group right when they were about to start to go to the cloud. Like, they were just beginning that work. And so I saw initially what the problems were, and I was frustrated with the problems and watched as the transformation happened. And so a lot of this will be similar to many of you, or maybe not, but initially our organization was split into three distinct disciplines. We had program management, who created the specs, designed what features we would be building. We had developers, who were focused on code, get features done, code, get features done. And we had a test organization who was focused on manual testing and functional testing. And so they would write thousands and thousands of UI or API-based functional tests to hopefully give us a sense of quality. And so at this point, on a snapshot to what our team kind of looked like at this point. So we personally used a Kanban board to plan our workflow and see how our work transitions through different states. And so here's kind of an example of what our team looked like at that point. We would have three columns in a Kanban board. So we had two PMs, and so our Jose would have some specs on him. When he would finish one of those specs, we'd move it over and have a developer pick it up. They would work on it, they'd code. Their incentive was to code fast, get the feature done. They finished the feature, handed it over to a tester. The tester wasn't involved in the development, didn't know about all that went into development. They just started writing functional tests to validate it. And they would do this for a while. And it was very much throwing it over the wall. The developer said, I'm done with this. Here, you have it. I'm moving on to something else. And so the tester would do it. Eventually, maybe the tester would find an issue and then throw back over, and there'd be context switching, and they'd have to pick it up. And eventually, it would move past tests, and we'd have it done. And this is how we worked for a while, and we built up this huge suite of thousands of tests that we were maintaining also. And so the test organization also not only had to test the product, they had to actually fix the tests. Like, we had a constant problem of the suite of tests having issues, having bugs, or failing. And so they spent almost maybe 30% of the time just maintaining the tests, right? And then the rest of the time testing new things. Also, at this point in our journey, we had a two-year ship cycle, right? We were still just a box product, and we worked in these two-year cycles where we'd spend 6 months planning for the release. We would have the PM organization would think about all the features that we wanted to do going forward for the next 2 years, and we had the confidence here, I guess, to think that we knew exactly what the world was going to be like 2 years from now, right? Like, looking at the technology industry, how fast it changes, how many things have changed in 2 years, right? So, like, if you're planning 2 years earlier, there's no way you're gonna hit the mark of saying what people want and what the customers really need. In addition, the way we worked is that after that 6 month planning period, we would have 2 9-month development cycles, and so these would give us two opportunities to give customers value. After the first 9-month milestone, we would have a beta, where it would be the first and only time before releasing that customers can actually see the product. So we'd release this to customers, and then we'd start on another 9-month long development cycle and then deliver the final version of the product. And even here, we had the confidence to think that we could deliver these features in exactly this schedule, right? The PM spent 6 months planning, and they thought that we would be able to, as engineers, hit these marks and get all these features done in 2 9-month cycles, which I don't think has ever happened. And also, this long cycle here presented another problem, because the way we worked with the dev and test discipline is that the devs would build so much debt, because they're focused on features, is that we would have to buffer a lot of time just for bug fixing, testing, and stabilization. So in reality, even though each milestone was 9 months long, we only developed features for 12 weeks, right? And it feels kind of crazy, right? Like, they spent 6 months planning, and we had 2 12-week development cycles to actually develop all of that. And so then we had to spend so much time stabilizing, because after 9 months, we didn't have many opportunities to get quality out. Like, if we ship bad stuff on RTM, we didn't have another way, except for months later, to fix any issues. And so we're very fearful. We're afraid to ship bugs. And so we had to really take our time to make sure that we crossed off every single thing on our list of issues to make sure that we deliver a product that wouldn't be considered like shoddy. And so yeah, as I mentioned, like the debt built up and we had to keep stabilizing it. And this had another effect on our team, right? So you finish your development, and now all the engineers who really want to give customers value are feeling like they're trudging uphill, just fixing issues. And like, I love fixing customer bugs, but every single time I fix a bug, it makes me like, sometimes I feel like another issue. Like, what are we doing wrong? Why is the quality so low? And doing this for 3 straight months of just fixing bugs, it's somewhat demoralizing at times because you question, like, where's the value? What am I really doing to increase customers' ability? The other key problem we had here is that given that we only had 12-week development cycles, right, we would ship the beta, but by the time customers were actually downloaded, installed the beta, used it, and sent us feedback, we were already well into the next development cycle. And so we really weren't built to have time to react to customer feedback. And I mean, this is crazy, right? Like we're doing this beta, but the beta really didn't serve the purpose it was intended for, right? You would use the product, find an issue, find a feature you wanted, find something that was wrong, and send it to us, and we would have to say, awesome, that's great feedback, you hit the mark, we can't do it right now, we're already done developing. We'll get this in for the next release. I mean, I was a customer of these products also, and that is incredibly frustrating to have your feedback validated and then said, you'll see this in a year and a half, you'll see this in 2 years, right? I mean, I would go to use another product because like I feel like the company is not listening to me. So we knew this was a problem. We knew that we had to have faster cycles. We couldn't build this debt. And so our initial idea to try to fix this problem was to shrink our development cycle down, shrink our testing cycle down to sprints, to 3-week sprints, right? We still weren't gonna ship every 3 weeks, but it was just maybe make it so that teams had to get code complete every 3 weeks and then start over again. And this was a very common trend in the industry. Agile and Scrum methodologies very much encourage this. And so we thought that that's our solution, right? Naively said, that's what we need to do. The problem is these long milestones, let's just make it smaller. And so when we first started doing this, it worked for some teams, right? We gave our entire organization training on Agile methodologies. Everyone seemed to understand it. We said, go do it. So Team A got it, understood it. They kept debt down. They built features, tested it, great. But not every team did. Most actually didn't. And so you still had Team B, who built, debt, and got to this crescendo mark where we now had to stabilize again. Because B had built up so much debt that we still couldn't ship a product. And so not only would B have to go and stabilize, A had to stop doing their fast cycle and help them, because we still couldn't ship a poor quality product. And at this point is when we realized as an organization the problem was bigger than just do sprints and we're fine. We realized that we really weren't being competitive, right? Customers wanted the feedback to be heard. Our employees wanted to feel that they can deliver value. And the industry was moving. The industry was moving to this cloud model already, right? It was becoming, everyone wanted faster cadences, and we weren't there. And as Jose alluded to earlier, right? As a team who built an ALM product, how could we conceivably sell to our customers, hey, we're an ALM product for DevOps, when we weren't even close to DevOps ourselves, right? If our tool was gonna work for them, we had to make it work for us, so we had to figure out how to achieve a DevOps development cycle.
So as Matt mentioned, the change was way bigger than what we anticipated. It was essentially moving to the cloud meant for team services, for our organization, transforming our culture. And I think I want everybody to understand that that's not something easy, right? That's not something that happens in a single day. And we learned that the hard way. And I think by hard way, I mean we learned that by not being perfect the first time we did it, right? We learned through the process. And in this presentation, what we've done is essentially we've grouped our learnings into what we call guiding principles. And I've grouped them into two sections. One of them is guiding principles that I think can drive alignment in your organization. And what I mean by alignment is these are changes that, in our case, happen at an organization level. They wanted to help, with these changes, we wanted to help not one team, not two teams, but all the teams in the organization. And then we have the second piece of it, which is, okay, that's great, but the reality is this is not a recipe, right? Every team has its own culture. Every team has its own personality. I think about teams as an organic entity, right? They keep getting better, they evolve. And you cannot just go and say, you know what? All of our teams, let's just be Scrum. Because in reality, I don't think that actually may work, right? It may work for some of them, but maybe not for all of them. And it's important to understand that. Like, what is what makes my team as efficient as possible? Because that's the whole point of DevOps story, right? How can we improve our cadence? How can we improve the way we deliver value? How can we get faster, better over time? And that requires experimentation, right? It requires experiments. It requires being a little bit loose. How can we keep getting better? Now, something that resonates really, really a lot with our teams is this quote from the book Drive from Daniel Pink that says, let's try to give our teams three things: autonomy, mastery, and purpose. We'll dig a little bit deeper into these concepts later on the presentation, but I think we take this quote to heart. Like, we really need to make sure our teams are autonomous and they can make the decisions. They can develop their mastery in whatever it is they're working on, and they can get a sense of purpose, right? I remember when I started, it was really easy to tell what we were doing. Some of us could tell how we were doing it, but just a very few of us could tell why we are doing it. And I think that is key, right? Like, you want your whole team to know why you're doing something, because that makes them go the extra mile, understand what's the real value you're delivering to customers and why it matters. So let's take a look at first at the changes that happened throughout the organization and what that means for teams within the team services group. So as Matt described, initially, when we were a Box product, we had three very distinctive roles: PM, development, and testing. And as an organization and as a company, we decided that the right way to go was to do combined engineering, which meant that development now also required the engineer to go through the whole process of validating that it was quality work. He had the more context than anybody else because he was the one building the functionality, and he just had to make sure that the whole end-to-end experience was, you know, up to the quality bar. Making this change also meant to us that we needed to give our teams a little bit more help. From the program management perspective, it also meant that the program manager had to deal with the whole end-to-end. And this not only means writing specs, right? Our job didn't end there. It ended up with how can the customer really get the value? How can we talk about it externally through blog posts, forums, documentation? And how can we make sure the patterns we use are the right for the interactions that we want to drive from our users? From the engineering side, it also meant that we needed to learn how to do three-week deployments. And that meant that, you know what, we may need a service delivery team or set of resources that could help our engineering teams get good at it, make the deployments smooth. And that was something that we acknowledged early, and it's something that we still do today. When we develop a new set of functionality, we start by interacting with our UX designers. What is the right pattern? What is the right interaction we want to drive from our users, how we can talk about it externally once that's ready, and how we can deploy everything in an efficient manner. Now, our teams, the way they look today, they are teams made up of cross disciplines. In our case, we lead what we call the WITIQ team internally. We have two PMs and 10 engineers. And the idea for these teams is to remain intact for 12 to 18 months. Right? We want to give these teams that sense of mastery, of purpose. And in order to do that, they need to feel like a unit. kind of a family, right? They need to understand what is their goal, why it is important the work they're doing, and how it's affecting our customers. More importantly, they should have an autonomous backlog, right? As Matt described earlier, we understand the goal for the sprint, but management doesn't tell us how to get there. We define the way to get there, we understand what is the best practices we need to follow, how to break down work, and if we encounter problems, how to communicate those up to make sure we can pivot and deliver something that's high quality and that the customer can benefit from. So this is our team, and I think it's interesting because, and you'll see it in the next slides, we all work together in the same space, in a team room. And we collaborate quite a lot, and that's great. We come up with a new set of functionality, a new feature, and it doesn't start with the PM just, you know, going dark for 2 months trying to figure everything out. It starts with a lot of dialogue, right? All of the disciplines are highly integrated. The engineers provide certain concerns around how we're implementing it, concerns around the design, what's right, what's not. Because at the end of the day, as Matt mentioned, we are a DevOps organization that creates a tool that is supposed to get you to that DevOps state. And we need to make sure we hear perspective of all of the personas involved. So this is an example. This is actually our team room. This is actually our team back in Redmond. And I think the interesting piece is sometimes when we talk about team rooms, people get the idea that these are just open spaces. And I think they're way more than that. And the reason for that is these teams are cross-discipline teams all focusing on the same set of goals. These are not people that are working on different things at once. They are people that understand what the team wants to achieve, for when, and why we're doing it. Now, what does that mean? That means that on a day-to-day basis, we have conversations. We were having this great conversation, Matt and I, about, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, new functionality that we wanted to provide to customers. And we're discussing if it was valuable or not. And it was very interesting to see how more engineers can just jump in and have that freedom of saying, hey, you know what? I have this insight. You maybe want to consider this or that. And that involves in or makes other people want to jump in and provide their own context or their own expertise. You know what? There's certain requirements that I don't know if we can meet, man. And all of this is happening in a very collaborative manner through a lot of conversation, which is great. Because otherwise, in the old model, the PM would just go dark 2 months, create a set of specs that, you know what, will never be implemented, and then just create that for the team and kind of affect the timelines. When we were a box product, this is kind of how our teams look. We used to have the UI team, the API team, the data team, and they were driving horizontals. Now, what was the problem with that approach? Let's say something in the UI was broken for our users, but it was actually not a problem of the UI, but maybe it was a call we were making or some search mechanism that was now problematic. The UI team would get frustrated because they couldn't do anything to solve the issue. They had to wait and depend on another team. And just in the same way, if something was working correctly on the back end, but the UI was not displaying it correctly, then people in those other teams felt really frustrated. They also had a hard time understanding what is the real value they were delivering to customers, because sometimes they wouldn't see, like, their work wouldn't be impacting customers. And we tried to shift now to a model that strives for vertical. We control and own the full end-to-end. In Team Foundation Server, our team focuses on query experience, workout inform experience, customizing layout. And we own the full end-to-end. And that's great. Like, I think that boosts the morale of the team, and it allows us to also react quickly to feedback. Whether it's a call that's being made, whether it's UI, we have the means to solve problems for our team. So this is kind of the example of how at that point in time when we had just done that, our team looked like. In this case, we still had the PMs kind of putting their specs as user stories. Now we had a clear column called engineering, and we had introduced a new column called validation. Now the purpose of this column was not necessarily to recreate the test persona, but it was meant to stand for, you know what, now the engineering has to deal with full end-to-end, making sure the testing is there. But then we also wanted an additional pair of eyes to look at the end-to-end, at the full experience. Because what happens is sometimes we're developing, we have blinders, right? We think everything is great, and the reality is having that extra pair of eyes really guaranteed that somebody without context could come in and say, wow, why are you doing this? Or this makes no sense. Like, is this the right way of creating this experience? Is this the right set of steps that we want our user to go through? The other thing that we encounter, and I think this was more from the planning perspective, is we didn't speak the same language. In other words, I interact with a lot of different PMs, different teams, and when I went to them, I couldn't have a successful conversation because I couldn't understand what they were working on. Some of them track their work in user stories. Some of them track them via scenarios or epics. Some of them use features. And it was really hard to have a conversation and understand when things were landing. So with alignment and autonomy in mind, what we did was we agreed that scenarios and features were the way we wanted to talk about alignment. Scenarios were things that we wanted to deliver in 6 to 12 months. Features were what made up those scenarios, and they were essentially the atomic units of value we wanted to deliver to customers. And after that, we just said, you know what? It depends on every team. As long as the feature gets done and we can talk about that value and we can explain that to customers, the way the team approaches the work, it's up to the team. I've seen teams want to be granular. They create user stories. They break them down into tasks. I've seen teams that, you know what, use tasks as a checklist. And I've seen teams that only use user stories, which is our case. And this model allows us to have that level of autonomy, and the tool allows us to have that flexibility to configure those boards, those backlogs as needed. And I think last but not least, when we started, we knew we wanted to have shorter cadences. We knew we wanted to do sprints. But initially, those sprints meant different dates, which made conversation, collaboration harder. I would go and ask another PMA, when is this getting done? Because I have a dependency on it. And they will tell me it's sprint 2, which may mean completely different things to my sprint 2. And I think this is one of the hardest things to achieve, right? Because we have tools that may deploy in different cycles. And this doesn't stand necessarily for the deployment, even though we're showing it on the image, but it stands more of how can we structure dates in a way that makes sense, in a way where I can say, okay, are you delivering this in sprint 4, 5, 6? And so far, it's worked well for our organization. Today, we're not in sprint 1, we're not in sprint 10, we're actually in sprint 107. And so far, so good.
So we, at this point, we had a common language, we knew how to plan, but we had to know how to execute. So the change from the 2-year ship cycles to actually saying every 3 weeks we ship bits to customers is a big change. And it requires your engineering system and your tooling here to really support you, right? Yes, you could have a lot of rigor and do it without this, but having a good set of tools and a good set of practices helps you hit this cadence and be successful, because every 3 weeks, you have to deliver quality, right? You don't want to ship faster, but ship less quality. Customers aren't going to like that. And so for us at this point, we had to transition. Since our engineers were still in the mentality of that 2-year ship cycle. And so the way we worked then was big feature branches, integrate before you ship. And so when we first started doing 3-week ship cycles, the mentality was initially still there, where at the beginning of your 3 weeks, everyone creates a feature branch. Each team would have my team's feature branch. You start writing code. So for 2 weeks, you're just writing code. And then come the 3rd week, everyone says, awesome, let's go and merge our stuff together. And what do you think is going to happen at this point, right? Everyone's independently. We have 50 teams. Chaos, absolute chaos. I feel this very deeply because I went through this. I remember when I first joined the group, I was working on a big feature. I was really proud. I was excited. We were in a big feature branch that was there for a long time. And we finally said, okay, 3rd week, let's merge it. And I spent that entire 3rd week merging that feature. Because every single day, I would finally get one merge conflict fixed, say, I'm ready to go. And then another feature branch would have been merged in before me. and I'd have to start the process over again. Me and two other engineers spent that entire week just merging it, and we still couldn't get it done. We had to delay the feature. And my morale at this point was plummeted. Like, I was frustrated, because I got it working, but I couldn't get the feature in there. So, and this wasn't just me. Every team was hitting this problem, and it was a big source of frustration. And we knew something had to change, right? Unhappy people. So this is when we started investing in a different workflow, and we started to adopt Git at this point. Git is a version control system. It's considered a distributed version control system. But I'm not going to go too deep into Git, but the thing that Git enabled us to do is that it has very lightweight branching. In the system we used before, branches were a heavyweight thing. There was an overhead. You didn't want to do a branch for a day and move it back in. But with Git, that was actually the common and easy workflow. So we started this practice where every engineer, if you work on a feature, you would create what we call a topic branch, develop your feature for a couple days, merge it back in. You always would merge your feature back into master as soon as you could. You kept master to be the source of truth, and you get features in there as early as you can. Now, for some longer-lived features, we still did feature branches, and you can see in there we have some color coding for that. But those were rare. We encourage people not to do that, but if they did, we basically said you do not merge those feature branches the third week, right? If you're doing a feature branch, you have to make sure that comes in the first week or the second week at latest. So this helped make sure that by the third week, there was no major distractions, and our code was in master and ready to be built and deployed. But just changing to this model of constantly merging to master then also presented the problem in terms of how we tested our product. So a little bit of the terminology here. So we categorize our tests into these three categories, L0 to L3. And I don't need to talk about each and every one, but the basic idea is that L3, or we consider end-to-end UI tests, right? You have a test that goes, launches the web browser, launches the application, clicks on some buttons, asserts the state, and finishes. And when we had, before combined engineering, and we had pretty much only these. We had thousands of these. They were slow. To run them all would often take 4 hours, 8 hours, and they were never at 100% passing, right? We basically considered success to have them over 90% passing. But now when we're switching to this model of constantly merging into master, every engineer is not going to sit there for 8 hours before they merge to run this test and not even see 100% passing, right? Because the second you don't have 100% passing, you don't know if you introduced a failure or not, right? To know if you introduced a failure, you now have to spend another hour analyzing the difference between the tests before and the tests after and see, is that possible something I regressed? So we changed our model at this point to start really encouraging and pushing for what we call L0 tests, which are pure unit tests, whether JavaScript or C# or whatever language we use. They don't require a deployment. They just run on the code logic, and they validate that the business logic is correct. And we made this the predominant form of testing we had. We still have some of our what we call the L3 tests, but very few, and they can be run on a schedule every day, let's say, for master, instead of on every commit or check-in. And by making this change, we were able to really ensure that a master branch was always at a high quality. And this made, and to help with this, our product has a feature with our pull requests, where pull requests is pretty much how you merge your topic branch into master. It's just a kind of like a glorified code review where people can give you feedback, and it will automatically then, once done, put it in master. But if you notice on this slide, that we have a build succeeded on this slide. And that build builds your code as part of the pull request and runs your L0 unit tests. And if either of those fail, you can't put the code into master. You're blocked. And this is powerful because once we did this, we never had a test failure again, because no code can come in that had a test failure. So we could always guarantee our master branch was at 100% passing. So we had confidence that the logic was correct. The other thing that we had to do is that, so we're merging features very often, but often you don't know if your feature's 100% ready, right? Especially if you're doing new UI work or a new big change, you want to get some feedback loop from people doing bug bashes or other people in the organization using it, or even customers using it. And so we didn't want people to be afraid and keep things out of branches for a long time. We wanted the code to get in master and people to validate there. And so we started making heavy use of feature flags. So the way this works is that you make a topic branch, you do your code changes, but you include it in a branch of code that says, like, if this feature flag is on, run this code, otherwise, don't. And so by default, a lot of any new big risky features will do this way and have it off. You can keep writing code, keep merging into master, keep validating. So again, the logic is in master, it's just dark. And then eventually when you're ready and you've done more validation, you can just flip the flag on and have users see it. This really liberated us so that we weren't afraid of putting new features into master. If there's any concern, put it behind a feature flag. On my team, we'd have discussions with our engineers saying, okay, this feature sounds good. Like, how confident do you feel about it? Is there any risk? And they said, yeah, I'm not 100% confident. Okay, put it behind a feature flag. And then the concern is resolved. Like, we're not afraid of getting into the same branch as everyone else. And once we've then validated, turned it on, seen that users are successful with it, delete the flag from the code and move on. And this enabled us to have deliver value to customers really quickly. Because we can check these feature flags in and then deploy them to different rings of users. So the way VSTS deploys is that we have different rings of risk, kind of. We have SU0, which is what we actually run on, our product, which is our canary ring, right? We deploy to ourselves first and say, because if we break ourselves, we're going to break everyone else. So we'll deploy to our first ring and then maybe turn some features on, validate it. Does it sound good? Okay, let's deploy to the next ring. And we'll have an early adopter ring where these are not necessarily the entire general public. It's just basically maybe MVPs or people who sign up with us saying, hey, I really want to see the newest features soonest. I want to give you feedback. I'm okay if they're not 100% polished or maybe there's some bugs. And so we can do this iterative deployment and turn features on for different people who have different appetite for how new and how stable and get feedback fast. And like compare this to where we were with the 2-year ship cycle where we can only get feedback at 2 points and they're months apart and we can't react. Here, we can deploy to SU0, get feedback, stop deployment, deploy new stuff right away, and even respond to feedback in a day or 2 days, sometimes even in the same day. And then finally, when it's ready, turn it on for everyone and everyone has a nice, stable, well-vetted feature. And these changes had a huge impact on our morale. Because before, as I mentioned, engineers want their code to get out. The PMs want to see the features used. And having that long delta, it was frustrating. But with this change with feature flags and the engineering system of getting things into master, we got the code in there fast. You got your features out quickly. And every engineer felt empowered. They knew, what I'm working on, my customers are going to see. They're going to use. I can see feedback. Like, it's such a great feeling once you deploy. I just go on Twitter and I like wait to see someone tweet about it. And I respond to them saying, awesome, how do you like it? What could I do better? Knowing that if they give me feedback, I can react to it. I could conceivably say, hey, I fixed your feedback. It's going to be out tomorrow, or going to be out next week, or it's going to be out next deployment. So at this point, right, we had a good hold of how do we get code into master? How do we strip out features reliably? But the other big challenge we face when comparing to DevOps is how do we keep live site healthy? Since when you're the box product, that feedback cycle is very long, and you didn't get this constant stream of data from users. Once you move to DevOps, and as you scale, you have thousands of accounts, millions of users, all using your product at the same time. And so the burden of your engineering teams becomes, well, how do you ensure everything's successful here? Since it's a live system, you're constantly changing it, anything can break on any day. You need to make sure you're built to respond to it. And so our group had to heavily invest in telemetry. How do we know what's going on? And so it started small, but we built a very rich pipeline of gathering data from customers. And this data, right now, it's over 500 gigs a day, and I even think it's bigger than that now, of data that streams into our warehouses where we mine it. We'll run queries over it, we'll build dashboards over it, we'll analyze the data to see what's going on. And it's really important to have these streams of data because otherwise you're flying blind, right? If you really want to respond to customers, you need to be able to see what's going on without having to go customer to customer and asking. You need to see an aggregate. And so I put the word responsibly up there because like some people get concerned of like, you know, Big Brother, everyone's seeing my personal information. And even talking to a lot of you today at our booth in the expo hall, there's always a lot of concern about moving from on-prem to the cloud in terms of security. And so we take that very seriously. And so even us as engineering team looking at this data, we don't see personal information, right? We see data in aggregate. We see error logs. We see when you scrub data, like email addresses that we can't see. So we make sure that we're looking at the data that we need to look at. And if we ever need to look at data that is personal, we'll have to ask you as an account owner, can we look at this data? Which sometimes we will ask, but most of the time we don't need to do that. And so some of the type, and there's a lot of kind of metrics we have, but just a couple quick ones to focus on. So perf counters, and these are built into Windows. They're low-level counters showing like disk I/O, memory. We dump these to a table. We analyze, saying, okay, is the server running hot? Is it running on memory? Is SQL running slow? Traces where engineers are put trace points all over the code. Any place they think there might be an issue, we check in these things called trace points where it logs when it gets hit, how often, and some extra data. So we can go and say, okay, well, it looks like in this account, this trace point is hit way more than we expect to. Maybe the caching isn't working. And KPIs, which basically track our key scenarios. For example, for work item tracking, if we make a change that we think is going to help people make more work items or be more successful, we'll create a KPI metric and have a hypothesis saying, hey, when we deploy this change, we expect this metric to go up. And we'll be very data-driven there saying, okay, let's form a hypothesis, see what happens, and if it doesn't work, let's come back to the drawing board and say, why didn't that work? And with this change, back to our team had to change. Since before this, we were focused on feature development, get features out, high quality, ship to customers. But now we have this plethora of data coming in. And every team, including ours, had to be able to handle it and have capacity to analyze it. Because that data isn't just free, right? You look at it, and it's not like you instantly know what's going on. And so all our teams across our organization started implementing this idea of a team DRI, which is one person each sprint whose sole focus is not features. They don't touch a feature. They just look at production telemetry, customer feedback, and issues from the production system. And their goal is just to be responsive there. They'll look at these issues, they'll react to them. And this had a very transformative effect on our team because now we actually would often fix issues before a customer ever reported it to us. We'll see, hey, look, it looks like this user's hitting exceptions. They don't know it yet, but some of the things aren't working right. We'd go quickly see it and get a fix out to production to fix the user's issues. Compare this to the box product model. If you had an issue with that and reported us, it would be 2 years before you saw it. Now it could be days that we can get a critical fix to you and unblock you. And this really made me happy because anytime I see a customer's blocked and hitting an issue where they can't make progress, that's an unhappy customer. And by having this change and having someone focus on this, you can unblock them. And this enabled us for alignment to then make a set of metrics that all our teams can focus on. And this is a very busy slide, but the point of it is that we knew that we had a focus on lifecycle health, we had a focus on production, and so across our organization, we determined a set of metrics around quality, around customer feedback, around lifecycle bugs, that we were all our goal to keep low. And so by having a dedicated resource in each team, we were hopefully able to go and accomplish that goal.
So we've gone through pretty much all of the concepts for alignment, right? Those were the big changes that the organization was making and how it affected our team. And a lot of teams can stop there and they can be successful. But I think what we learned is that being autonomous gave us the ability to keep getting better at it. And we were kind of open waters. This was new to us. But we knew that we wanted to just, you know, keep getting better and keep experimenting it. And I think here's where autonomy, mastery, and purpose, and that quote from Pink's book becomes really, really relevant. In the book, autonomy stands for self-directed, right? Making decisions. And I think that's something that this new way of working gave us. We had an objective for the sprint, we had an objective for the next 6 months, but we had full control on how we decided to approach those problems. And that gives the team a sense of we're directing our own future to a degree. Mastery. urge to get better, right? I'm a soccer player. I love the game. I keep trying to get better over time. It's just fun. And I think the same applies to development, right? There's now this sense of urgency, this sense of how can we keep getting better for our customers? How can we keep getting better at it, at developing, at planning, at executing? And being autonomous gives you that, because you know that you can make changes that can improve the way you tackle things. And last but not least, purpose. And I love to focus on this one, because I bet you anything that a lot of people in your organization do not know why the things they're doing matter. We do know how we do them, what we're doing, but not why. And that's essential. In our team, whether you're an engineer, you're a PM, we make sure that we understand why we're doing them. And if we do not agree, we have a conversation around it, right? We need to make sure that all of our investments are ROI-driven, right? The value we're delivering to the customer is right. And if it's not, we need to make sure we can pivot and do what's right for the customer. Here's an example of what happened the first time, like when we got to this place where we could keep iterating as a team. We had a plan. We had a lot of user stories. And I guess we always think naively that you're going to be able to go through all of those, right? Nothing's going to happen in the sprint, no incidents, it's going to be perfect. Well, in reality, you're probably not going to be able to deliver all of those. And I think initially with the old mindset, we would think, well, that's bad. But wouldn't be able to react as a team and get better at it. With the new mindset, we were able to tell, okay, well, there's clearly a problem here. What can we do as a team to get better? And I think one of the big problems we were facing is when you're planning, you're thinking, well, I'm probably going to develop new functionality. And then we're probably going to do a couple of bug bashes. And incidents are going to start showing up, will start showing up at the end of the sprint. Easy. It's probably not going to be a lot. We're going to be good. In reality, that's not the case, right? You may start working on it. You may get some feedback. Some of the things that you thought you had validated were actually not true. Or you may encounter really big incidents or problems, or the requirement may just grow, right? We may have customers that say, hey, I wanted A, B, now I want A, B, and C, and I want to deliver by a certain date. And you need to make sure your teams are structured in a way that they can react to that. So things that we discover, why we were not being predictable. I think that a lot of us didn't plan for incidents or for feedback. Right? We just didn't embrace the fact that we wanted to get to customers in a quicker cadence and get their input quicker too. And that meant that we had to build our team around that principle. And we had to have people that could react to it. Context switching. Before, we were focusing on a lot of things at once. We were spreading ourselves too thin, right? You sometimes think that doing a lot of things at once is better than doing less teams but focused. And I think that was a hard one to learn, and it's a hard one to communicate to management, because when you go to your boss and say, hey, we're just going to be focusing on two things rather than four, it usually is, wait, what? Why? And it's not necessarily that the quantity is important, but the quality is. I'll better do two things really, really well than four at once and have to then pay the debt later on. Non-shared goals. I think by having more focus on your sprints, you can really tell what we're focusing on. When you have eight things at once, and somebody asks in your team, so why we're doing it, it's harder to explain than when you just have two and you say, well, we're doing this because for this sprint, PERF is our main goal. And that means that the stories we're delivering are all linked to that kind of PERF objective. And last but not least, silos of knowledge. And I think you guys probably have encountered this. You have the SQL expert in your team, or you have the UI expert in your team, and everything is perfect until the day he decides to either leave or take a vacation, right? Now, in our case, I guess one of the experiences we had was one of our team members took a vacation, and he was our SQL guy, the expert. And we got an incident during his vacation, so he was not available. And we realized that because he was the expert in the area, and we always leveraged his expertise, fixing the issue that could have probably taken him a week took us two or three times as long. So here's kind of where we ended after realizing we had all of these problems. And this is not, by no means, is where we want to end it. We keep improving and iterating on it and getting better. But we decided essentially that every sprint, we wanted to break down our team into two sub-teams. We call them the F team and the L team. If you guys are fans of Game of Thrones, the L team is kind of like our Night's Watch. They are the guys that are meant to, you know, cover or protect our feature team. They are the ones who are meant to respond to customer feedback when it comes, to bugs, incidents, critical issues. And they are there to make sure that the F team can really focus. Now, the other thing that we embraced was the fact that we needed to increase quality and embrace early feedback. From the moment a sprint starts to the moment a sprint ends, we're always collecting feedback, whether it's MVPs, whether it's external customers we have relationships with, whether it's our own internal engineers that use the tool, we want to hear from them. Because it's okay if we didn't get it right the first time, and it's okay to keep iterating on it. Last but not least, our L team not only focuses on bugs and incidents, but also on making sure that we keep improving our engineering system. Test migration, just like Matt mentioned before, it's important, and we make sure that we dedicate resources for that. Perf, even reports that we generate, how can we automate those to make sure that people in this team can be more efficient? And I think last but not least, and I think this is one of the things that when we talk about it, scares people, is we rotate these teams. Initially, we took these rotations were sprintly rotations. And as a team, we discovered that maybe sprintly rotations was not the best approach. And we reduced them to weekly rotations, which means that every week, people switch between L and F team, and the knowledge gets shared. It may be bumpy initially, right? It's a different way of doing things, but surely it can get better over time and make sure that your teams can execute better, and you don't run into that problem where the SQL guy is off on vacation and you cannot respond fast to your customers. And just as an example of this is kind of how our board looks today. You can see that we have two very distinctive swim lanes, one for the L team and one for the F team. You can see that above, there's a lot of things happening, and if I actually showed you the real board we have today, you'll see that there's a lot of things going on, because we may have issues, we may have critical incidents we need to take a look on, some engineering improvements, and that's okay. Underneath, you can see that the amount of cards is smaller, yet if you recall from our image, we're actually breaking our teams most of the time evenly. And the way we do that is engineers actually are doing pair programming, which I would say has been great for us. Collaboration in our team is great. And I think that's one of the pieces I enjoy the most of working where I work, which is I come in early, I sit down, and I can just hear engineers collaborate, talk, discuss, sometimes fight, but you know it's that's okay. And it's something that before doing this change, I didn't see, right? Like I had a guy working on a feature, and there was not this sense that you could just collaborate, have a dialogue, a conversation, and just help each other. And now there is. So I guess to leave a couple minutes for Q&A, if you're gonna take anything out of this presentation, I think I would like to focus on three things. As with our story, alignment and autonomy are important. I think alignment talks a little bit more to the science, while autonomy is more like an art. This is just what we've done for our team, but by no means is a recipe that you can just go back to yours and try to follow. Because I bet anything, your culture, your practices, the personality of your teams may be different. So don't try to be overly prescriptive. Making mistakes, it's okay, because you'll get better over time. Don't copy others, but learn from others. We've kind of discussed a couple of the mistakes we did along the way, things that we hadn't accounted for. And just learn from that. Try to apply it to your own company, to your own organization and teams. And last but not least, a lot of times I have conversations around behaviors and culture. And I think a lot of times we just wanna make our teams follow certain behaviors, But as we learned, that's not the right way to go. I think the right way to go is make sure you set the right culture. In our case, a DevOps culture. And you'll realize that behaviors just follow through when people understand what's the culture of the organization, what we're trying to achieve, how we're trying to achieve it, and more importantly, why. Thank you, guys. We're now open for questions.
And we'll take as many questions as we can right now, and we'll be available afterwards and at the Visual Studio Team Services booth. But we're also, both Jose and I are active on Twitter, so if you can't get a hold of us, you have any questions ever, those are our Twitter handles. Please tweet us whenever you want. We'll respond. We care about hearing your feedback and talking with other people and hearing their stories and learning from you guys, too. So thank you.
A question for you. Beyond the developers being responsible for unit testing, you have basically a final QA team that does final validation of feature complete, any introduced bugs that the developer working on a feature may not know of. I would call it basically final QA testing. We're struggling with trying to figure out what the industry standard is for ratio of those sorts of QA people.
So
what are you guys using internally? What are you seeing works?
So we don't have any QA people in our group right now, right? The developers do the functional testing, they do the unit testing. And then as a team, we will do bug bashes and we'll basically sit together as a team and work through our features together as like a larger group. So like we have like four or five teams who work just in the work-item tracking system. And so every sprint, we will have a community bug bash where every team will basically bug bash the other team's features to get new eyes on it. But it's still the engineer's responsibility to make sure they did the proper functional and unit testing.
Okay, then the other question is, what has been your experience with feature flags when that feature actually impacts the data tier and that data tier is coupled? How are you guys getting around that, or what are you doing?
That's a good question. That's the trickiest part, right, of the feature flag, because your data has to be ready for it. And so it causes us to be smart about how we write our features, right? If you're gonna do a destructive data change, you need to try to figure out, well, can you do that safely without needing the new functionality? And so we try to, if we're gonna make a change that has to change the schema, that's harder to feature flag. Especially if you're using SQL. If you're using a different kind of, like NoSQL, you might be easier, but we'll typically try to do them independently. Like, okay, isolate the schema change, make it safe, do it by itself with the old code, and then basically make the new functionality and the old functionality both work on the old schema. Sometimes it's not possible, right? There's no silver bullet, but that's what we strive for.
You talked about validation before, so is your team itself doing the validation, or do you invite people from other teams?
So that validation column, yeah, is typically our team. So what happens is, because he mentioned the blinder thing, like I have the same problem. If I write a feature, I know how it works, and I, like maybe like psychologically, don't touch the areas I think it might not work in. And so we basically, on our team, hand it to one developer who was not involved with the development. And it's basically a point of pride for them to try to find an issue, right? Like, because everyone will thank them. Like, if you can shake this hard enough and make a nut fall out of that tree, that means you've helped the customer. And so, we'll just basically, like, when you finish a feature, you'll say, hey, Joe, can you please validate this? And then he'll go and work on it for a day and really validate that it works.
Yeah, and I think on top of that, we do also host Sprintly bug bashes that include the whole set of teams. So that's 50 eyes. And we actually describe the scenarios, and the teams just engage. They create bugs or issues they encounter along the way, and we just try to treat them as if they were our customers, you know, creating those for us, and tackle those before we release the functionality to customers.
Thank you. And I have one more additional question, if I may. You talked about how you eliminated the QA teams altogether. Basically, you said that your teams, engineering teams, Every one in the team is a cross-functional, I mean, you know, from UX. So how far practically it was feasible for you initially? I mean, of course, you know, people always specialize. You know, I have AngularJS developers in my team who wouldn't touch anything else, right? So even though I tell them, you know, you need to have, you know, today with microservices architecture, you can even serve up your UI using your API layer, right? So, I mean, I have those ideas, but you know, everybody in my team is kind of already specialized. So how do you tackle that?
So yeah, we the way I look at my team is that I want my team to operate successfully, and I need everyone to be able to be capable of fixing any issues that come in. And so while I'm not saying people shouldn't have specialties, like I have people on my team who really prefer back end and some really prefer front end, but I raised at least a common level that they all are capable at everything else. And so the front end people may still try to take more front end work, but I build a baseline capability in every single person so that if there is a SQL issue or back end issue, they're still capable of working on the feature and taking the feature end to end. On my team, even some people who preferred UI, once they start pair programming and working with others in the back end, they learn it, they learn to like it. Because a lot of times the hesitance to do other tiers is not so much because they won't like it, it's because they never learned it and they've never been helped to feel confident in it.
Thank you.
Sure.
So my question goes a little bit past, you know, development, QA. But with an operations team that has the checks and balances in place for when things go to, you know, production environment. And I assume you also put the automation in place or had the automation in place to get those deployments out. Mm-hmm. But how do you deal with those checks and balances from an operations perspective before the code can actually be blessed to go into production?
What kind of checks and balances are you thinking about?
So, you know, maybe a member of the operations team being comfortable that, you know, what you're putting out is going to be supported by the hardware in terms of scale, you know, with Azure in particular, and making sure that they're going to be able to support it from that perspective.
Yeah, so basically we don't really have a full operations team, right? Because we are our operations team. So in one of the slides, Jose showed that we have a service delivery team. They are not an operations team. They're just basically there to facilitate the deployments and make and watch them with us. But it's up to the engineering teams to do that work already as part of the engineering cycle. Like, anytime we write a new feature, it's up to us to prove that, well, is this going to be performant? Is it going to work on our servers? We need to understand our production topology and also write the right telemetry. So as part of our exit criteria for any feature, we have to say what telemetry has to be added so that we can prove when we go to ring zero that it's working correctly. So we'll be aggressive, think about it, test it locally, go to ring zero, and then before we'll move on, prove that it's working the way we want. And if it's not, we have the ability of basically filing a, what we call a production blocker bug. We tag a bug saying deployment blocker, deployment stops, and we have to work quickly to fix it. But that's actually almost an embarrassing thing. It happens, but it means that we didn't do a thorough enough job beforehand to prove that this was actually gonna work in production. Can you go to the mic? I can't hear you as well.
So one of the things I'm curious about, when we looked at your L0 through L3, there probably was, you know, certainly a big shift in going from all of those L3 to L0s. Developers weren't writing L0 and L1 tests for a reason, I would expect. Maybe it was not just a skills, maybe it was an emphasis, but I'm curious what changes or things you had to do to help build up the bench of strength from your developer standpoint so they felt comfortable writing the right tests and increasing the number of tests so you could shift left to L0 and L1 instead of all those L3 tests. Thanks.
It was a really hard transition and still honestly going on right now, right? Like my team right now is still working on reducing those L3 tests. Cause like you're not gonna suddenly shut down your organization and have everyone just work on tests. It's a over time gradual transition. But I guess the problem for us when I first joined the group, because I've always been big into unit testing, I'm passionate about it. And when I joined the group, there wasn't a culture that believed in it, right? They thought, well, unit testing is great, but you'll never be better than end to end, right? End to end is actually testing the product. How could you be better than that? And you know that mentality didn't account for the cost, right? Can you keep it stable? A failing test is worthless. What's the time to run it? What's the turnaround time? And so it took a while to educate everyone that, well, yes, end-to-end is great, but if you can get 90% of that coverage using a lower level test, do that. And it caused education. We did training sessions in a group about unit testing. We kind of showed them the industry standard, how this is where everyone's moving. And it took a lot of time to educate teams. Like I worked on it a lot with my team and teams in my group. And it slowly, we got higher up in the organization to buy into it, to realize that we're never going to be able to ship fast unless we do this. And slowly the mindshare and the culture began to change to really believe in it. But it required both bottom-up engineers beginning to be trained at understanding how to do it, and top-down management saying, this is what we believe in. And until you had both, we weren't able to actually change the culture.
So earlier in the presentation, you had shown like a large team that you had, 435 mm-hmm. people or so. What were some of the challenges adopting this kind of a culture, DevOps culture, across all these remote teams that you had?
Are you talking more along the lines of collaboration and how to?
Yes.
Yeah, I think from a collaboration perspective, what's really important is having that taxonomy and that common cadence. I would probably put that as the most important, because unless you have that, it's really hard to have an effective conversation, right? Like an efficient one. I think that is really, really important. The other thing that we do that we don't show in the deck, but we do it every sprint, is we make sure all of our teams across the board send out what we like to call a sprint summary email, which is essentially what we worked this sprint, what we're planning on working the next sprint. And the idea is not for them to be lengthy emails. It's more to just showcase like, hey, this is a set of functionality we're working on. And those serve as a really good starting point into enabling conversations, right? I see something that may be related to something we drive or we own. We may need to have a conversation just to guarantee that it's a good decision, right? The other thing that we do is our management levels. Each vertical essentially has a management level that it's aware of the work they're doing. And the same way we collaborate with teams on the bottom side, they collaborate on the top side, making sure that they're aware of what teams are working on, what's coming next, and discuss any impacts that may have. For example, we're working on a combined feature with some folks in India. And the reality is that my manager and my team involved through me, we have conversations with that team and say, hey guys, we love that you're working on it. Let's just stay in sync. And it's not a perfect science, but it's one that so far having those steps have really helped us.
When you're describing the teams, every member of the team looks like they have a reason to use team system every day. But earlier in the deck, you had a slide deck that was showing the adoption of a team system across the organization. And there was about, I would estimate about 10% of the users that were one day only, or 1 to 12, I think it was, 1 to 12 days they were using it. What type of users were those?
So there's, our product still is being adopted across the company. So like in some groups like ours, which is not a great example because since we built the product, but like most of the people in our group are using it almost every day. But it's used across a large part of the company. And so some teams are still in the middle of adopting, so they're still kind of figuring out what their workflow is. And sometimes you have a lot of people, like you'll have overseas testers, you'll have, for some teams still do that. And you'll have different capacities where you have like upper management or people who don't need to be day-to-day in the tool. It's more of like, okay, I'll check it today, make sure everything's aligned, and they're not daily using it. But typically people more in the lower level in terms of day-to-day engineers are in there every single day seeing what items are assigned to me.
In such a large organization, I come from a large organization, I know you have resource churn. So with new resource coming in and with an evolving and iterative process that you're building, right, that you've changed a lot over time, how are you bringing in new resource and introducing them to this methodology in a way that's consistent and then also changes as you guys are changing? How are you documenting and growing and introducing new resources to this methodology as you go? Because that's a challenge for us, and just curious if you've got any tips or tricks.
Yeah, any organization this size, you're right. Like there's always attrition, there's always turnover. And so at least me personally, our team, we try to build to optimize for that situation, because getting new people is great, right? There's new ideas, new culture, new thoughts. And so the things that really help us there is the team room is a big help there, because I know like when I used to work in individual offices, there's almost like it's hard to go and walk into someone else's office and talk to them. Like you feel like it has to be important. Like I don't want to waste this person's time. But by being in the team room, that barrier for communication is low. And so like we set the culture in that team room that if you have a problem, just start talking. Someone's going to respond to you. And We've actually just had a new college hire on our team recently, and at first he didn't buy it. Like, you can see, like, he was quiet, he didn't want to talk, but then he noticed that I didn't shut up, right? Like, I'm constantly talking, and other people are talking back to me. And so he began to say, okay, wow, this is actually the culture, and now he starts to talk with us and interact and hear, and like, now I see him a month later, or 2 months later, and he's interacting with us, asking for feedback, and he's opened up and feels like the team culture.
Yeah, so that makes sense at that smaller team level. So cross team, they're like organization wide, when you're talking about this iterative growth and this, you know, process shift, what is the level and how is that getting communicated? Are the program managers all meeting on a regular basis and saying what works, what doesn't, and evolving that, or how does that communication work?
Yeah, so from a program management perspective, we do meet quite often, the whole, I guess, horizontal of program managers across teams. And we do talk about it, and we try to share our learnings, right? Because this is not it's not a science, I always call it an art, because I've seen teams be very successful with different approaches. But you do want to share the learnings, right? Like, for us, pair programming has been great. It has been great from engineers that we hire, that get into the team, develop, learn quickly, and they just get better way more faster than they used to do in the past. And even from the program management perspective, so we showed you our team. We have two program managers. One of them, Lauren, she just joined maybe a month ago. And being in this team setting that promotes collaboration, communication, and just embracing the fact that you may make mistakes, she's seen like it's a place where she's safe, and she feels safe, and she can just collaborate, provide her own input, her own insight, and I think that also helps just kind of develop people quicker, and serves as a great data point when we meet together and be like, look at her, like she just came in, she's been here for a month, and now she's already delivering value.
Thank you.
How much documentation are you doing? You know, what's the difference between the old approach and the new approach?
I think right now, whenever we... So just so everybody hears, the question was, how are we dealing with documentation today compared with in the past? And I would say there's no new set of functionality that goes out where we don't discuss what do we need to document for it. How can we make our customers successful? Now, are we perfect at it? No, but it's something that we now take really seriously, because the problem is if I do get a great feature out, but you're not aware of it or you don't know how to use it, then we're failing, right? Like it doesn't matter if it's out there, if you don't know how to use it or even know if it's there, we're failing. So I think we're taking this approach where even when, as we develop our specs, we think about the docs. What do we need? Do we need a blog post? Do we need a MSDN article? Do we need something else? And I think you're going to start seeing from us a little bit more of training material to make sure that people understand how to better use our tools and how to approach problems better. Yeah.
So did you see any of your teams that aren't co-located?
Our team is not 100%. My team has one person. We're in Redmond. We have one engineer in North Carolina, and we have one engineer in China.
Any challenges related to that you can share as far as being able to, you know, promote that culture?
So the North Carolina one is actually easy. We actually have you see those robots around this building today? We don't have one as fancy as that, but we just basically put a computer on a stand and with a good speaker, and he always Skypes in, and he's a live session to the team room. Because it's only a 3-hour offset, so for the most part, he's online during working hour. He can hear the conversations in the team room, and we can talk to him like a person. Like,
just have an open Skype type of session?
100% of the time, and we make a lot of robot jokes, but besides that, it actually works really well. Our employee in China is much more difficult, because China's time offset is really, really hard to deal with, because he's pretty much awake when we're asleep. And so that one's been much more difficult for us, and I'm excited about it, because it's a learning opportunity for me. So we're having to really put a lot more information into our user stories. It used to be because of the team room. Okay, just throw in a line, we're in the room, just talk about it. And now we need to make sure that we drop all information in there, so that when he comes online, when I'm asleep, he doesn't have to ask questions, he can go. And so it's causing us to be much more rigor in terms of dumping all the context we have. Like if we have a chat in the team room, throw it in that OneNote, throw it in the work item, just to make sure that he, when he comes online, isn't missing that information.
One more question related to the bug bashes. It sounded like you had two kind of styles. You had a team level bug bash and then maybe something larger across the feature mm-hmm. group. And if that's the case, how do you, any thoughts about how you guide those? Some yep. some developers may not be that familiar with that.
Yeah, so we follow, I guess the practice we follow is we have repetitive invites every 3 weeks. And in those invites, we have a description. Like, hey guys, we're testing, we need to really make sure our scenarios are rock solid. Here's what you need to know. And people that are already acquainted with the process do not really read through all the sections because they know how it works. But for new people, it's really helpful to understand, well, scenarios are described here. This is what I have to be watching for. And then after that, it's essentially just going out, testing it, and recording anything they see with enough information for us to track it in a OneNote. And the beauty of it is that our teams are located on Redmond, all of the work item tracking teams. So if you encounter a bug, they give you their alias. You can just ping them and be like, hey, I was looking at your problem, and I have a couple questions. And it's like it improves over time. So we always learn of what works, what doesn't, and we just keep improving it to better fit the needs of the organization.
How much time do you guys
generally the invite has? Yep. I think we're getting the signal that we need to stop. So we'll take more questions offline or at our booth offline. We'll be available.
Thank you, guys.